I didn't have a good feeling that we were going to find Denise alive.
I want to know why my daughter, Case, got put on the back burner. You know, I just want answers. Any answers that I could get, I just want answers.
I'm Jackie O'Brien, and this is episode 6 of Buried in Snow, an investigation into the unsolved murder of Denise Hart, a beautiful 24-year-old student and mother whose story, at least the whole story, has gone untold until now. So far, we've focused on the first month Denise was missing from various perspectives, and that's where most of the information I have on the investigation comes from. But Denise was missing for 11 months. The whole time, her family was left waiting, hoping Vermont State Police would find something. And they never did.
And I can't say for sure that they really searched because I'm in Connecticut.
Remember, there were also snowstorms when Denise went missing, which increased her mom, Deidre Robinson's, worries that police weren't trying as hard to find her daughter. I asked now Captain Julie Scribner about this concern.
Yeah, I mean, so certainly, I remember the weather that particular year, we had a bunch of snow. We had the temperatures were bitterly cold in the single digits for, and this is just in my memory, single digits for like a week or two in a row, which even in Vermont is a little unusual. So yeah, obviously weather conditions can hamper any search effort. You know, the snow covers up tracks or evidence. The cold makes it difficult for people that are out searching because, you know, you just can't withstand being out in those elements for, you know, lengthy periods of time. So, yes, I would say that the weather definitely hampered our initial efforts.
Police searched for 11 months and were unable to find Denise's body. Instead, a dog walker found it right off the road in Goshen, Vermont, 13 miles from where the car she was driving had been found burning. What were police doing for almost a year? And why weren't they able to find Denise?
I do know one thing, and I could say this, that if this would have happened in Connecticut, not saying that we don't have no unsolved murders, but I bet you I would have known more than what I know from there.
Like we've heard in previous episodes, Vermont State Police lost the trust of Denise's loved ones when they initially opened the investigation a week after her disappearance. Faith that police were working their hardest dwindled more over the months as Deidre couldn't get answers and ended up feeling like a bother for asking about her own daughter's disappearance. Detective Julie Scribner was the only officer who seemed to understand that Deidre was a victim in this too, and that ignoring her, even if they didn't have new answers, made her daughter's disappearance even more painful.
Like I said, if I didn't get a call every day, it was every other day, that Detective Julie called me after a month of my daughter being missing. You know, me and Detective Julie was talking as parents, and I said to her, you know, at this point, this is just y'all looking for her body, basically. She's not going to say this to her son. It's been a month now, almost really like a month and a half now. And she was like, yeah.
I didn't have a good feeling that we were going to find Denise alive. I conveyed that to her mother. I mean, probably not in the first week or two, but, you know, as the investigation continued, I was very frank with her mother that I would be honest with her as this went along, but I was not encouraged that we were going to find her alive.
So at this point, police know they're looking for a body, but where were they looking? One thing we know from local media coverage is that they searched a property in Sudbury on February 11th, but it's not specified if this is a new property or they were researching Josh's place.
I went through freaking complete hell trying to be framed for this murder when they were barking up the wrong tree for how many months instead of looking for the killer. And then I finally went and got clean and went to rehab and came out, did a polygraph test, and I said, I have to be done with this.
I asked Josh if Denise's disappearance is why he went to rehab. He said it had something to do with his final decision, but that his mom had died the summer before, in August 2014, and he'd been going downhill ever since.
you're the first person I've talked to about it, other than my girlfriend and her uncles, and after I talked to police officers, and, well, March 3rd of this year was 6 years since I went to Serenity House, so 5.5 years, probably.
Serenity House is a residential rehab in Wallingford, Vermont. They provide detoxification and treatments to Vermonters suffering from substance use disorder. Josh went to Serenity House in March of 2015 and has stayed sober ever since.
If they do catch somebody, if they find out that it is somebody, I'd like 5 minutes in the room with them by myself, because I almost had murder framed on me because of that. And my life was, you know, thank goodness it wasn't ruined because of the drugs alone, but having possible murder framed, that was not a very good couple months there. Even though I knew it, I was still, it was the words of a drug addict coming out, and it didn't, you know, and I was like, it doesn't matter what I say, they don't believe me, I'm a drug addict, they don't protect my word's nothing right now.
Josh has shared this suspicion with me before, that Vermont State Police didn't trust his word as a drug addict, which is interesting, because as far as I can tell, he was their main source up in Vermont. It makes me wonder how seriously police took his tip about Chris Richards and Todd Norris, two local guys who were heroin and crack addicts respectively. Josh heard they told another dealer they'd gotten rid of his competition 2 weeks after Denise went missing. Josh says he told police about this before going to rehab. But is he right? Did police ignore his tips because they were coming from a drug addict? Once he was out of rehab, Vermont State Police tried to get Josh to go undercover for them.
They're trying to get me my license because I didn't have a license. They said, oh, we'll get you your license if you help us go. And I said, wait a minute. Do you want me a month out of Serenity House going to drug dealers' houses to ask them questions for your investigation? That I don't want to be going anywhere near a drug house. I said, I just got out of Serenity House. I said, how could you even think about asking me to do that when you know I would love to, but that's not very healthy right now. I mean, I know they have to do stuff because that's what I said, but you're putting somebody's sobriety in jeopardy just to catch this or that.
Josh told police he didn't want to be involved in the investigation and asked to take a polygraph test to clear his name.
Once I took the polygraph test, I said, you know, I said, I have to work on my sobriety. I cannot be completely getting called and to run here and to have this, you know. And they were like, well, don't you want to, I said, it's not about finding the answer. I said, that's your guys' job. I said, I'm just letting you know once I clear my name that you can look to somebody else because you're still hooked on that I did it. And you're wrong. You are wrong. And after the polygraph test, and they never talked to me again. They never called and never tried.
Josh passed the polygraph test. These were some of the questions they asked him.
If I knew where she was, if I knew where her body was, if I knew if I did any bodily harm to her, you know, all those questions. And they already had the answer that I knew nothing of that.
Even though there is some question to the reliability of polygraphs, it seems like Vermont State Police eliminated Josh as a suspect because of it. I wish I could know more about how they went from focusing heavily on Josh to clearing him entirely, but when I asked Vermont State Police about Josh outright, they wouldn't say a word. Among other things, they also wouldn't tell me where they searched for Denise.
I mean, we certainly, anywhere that we knew that she had been recently, so even if it's somewhere like, oh, we know, and I'm not saying that this is the case, but like, oh, we know that she, you know, used to frequent, you know, McDonald's. And so we would, you know, I mean, our search went very wide in Vermont and as well as out of state as well.
Vague answers like this are all the information I have for the chunk of time between Josh's polygraph in March and news coverage the week of August 18th, when Vermont State Police returned to the Cornwall-Salisbury-covered bridge where the car Denise borrowed was found on fire and searched Otter Creek below. They checked here initially, but I guess this time the creek was thawed. Of course, it probably had been for a few months. What were they doing those months? And did they look into Chris Richards and Todd Norris? I'm not getting those answers from police, so I turned to my favorite investigative tool, Facebook, and crossed my fingers that one of them had a public profile still up. Luckily, Todd did, and he posted a lot that year, specifically about Chris. Who were Chris Richards and Todd Norris? I knew they were two guys in their 40s who were both addicts with long rap sheets, and asked Josh if either of them were dealers.
Chris, I mean, he has. He gets it, does it, sells what he has to make a profit, to keep going himself. Todd, he didn't do any of the heroin. He was more smoking crack and stuff like that. He probably dealt a little bit, nothing like. The thing about Todd was he was his best customer, so you can't really deal drugs and do them because you do your profit before it's even sold. So you can't. A drug addict cannot be a dealer at the same time. So he cannot. He could probably sell dope, but he's a crack smoker, so he just spend all his profit on smoking crack.
That's interesting because the same year as Denise's disappearance, 2015, Todd was convicted of federal trafficking charges. Both men had long arrest records, especially Chris, who'd been arrested for a number of things, including grand larceny, driving under the influence, aggravated assault, and possession of marijuana, cocaine, and narcotics. But as far as I could tell from snooping on Pacer, Chris never saw any jail time. In fact, I couldn't find a single court document on charges brought against Chris. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean he never went to jail. Maybe his records were sealed. I don't exactly know. What I do know comes from court records for Todd, who was arrested for conspiring to distribute crack cocaine on February 25, 2015. Court documents from him and his co-defendant's trial include an affidavit from the arresting officer who used a confidential informant referred to as Jefferson. The affidavit lists Jefferson's criminal history, which includes violations of conditions of release, retail theft, unlawful mischief, disorderly conduct, cocaine possession, inciting another to commit a felony, DUI, attempt to elude police, careless and negligent operation, aggravated assault, simple assault, marijuana possession, possession of narcotic drugs, driving while ability impaired by alcohol, failing to obey police officer, leaving scene of property damage accident, no license, and forgery. Notice how a number of these match up with the arrest records we know Chris Richards had. The affidavit goes on to say the police sent Jefferson into Todd's co-defendant's house wearing a wire with $250 to buy drugs from him and Todd, who were recorded discussing selling Jefferson crack cocaine. They left for 20 minutes and came back with 2 grams of crack for Jefferson. I found the court document after scouring Todd's Facebook page, where he posted a status on June 13, 2015 that said, quote, Chris Richards from Leicester, Vermont is a confidential informant for the FBI. Here are some of the comments that people left. Quote, I could have told you that, hence why he got in so much trouble and avoided jail time, end quote. Quote, no shit, has been a long time, end quote. Quote, heard he had a hand in that black young drug dealer, female, one still missing. End quote. Quote, what's going on? You told me that years ago. End quote. Quote, he has murder charges over his head. End quote. People commented backing these things up, saying him and his girlfriend were both informants and had gotten away with crimes for years because of it. A month later, on August 25th, Todd was sent to Raybrook Federal Prison in Essex County, New York. I needed to know more about these rumors and messaged everyone who commented on any of Todd's posts about Chris. Only one woman responded to me, the one who commented about Chris being involved in Denise's disappearance. I reached out to her saying, hey, I'm looking into the 2015 unsolved murder of Denise Hart, also known as Tiffany Robinson. I've heard that people think Chris Richards and Todd Norris were involved and found you in the comments of a post Todd made. I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about either or both of them. Her response? I know they are all dead. I said, yes, I saw you commented on a status saying you heard he had a hand in the young black female drug dealer's disappearance. That's whose murder I'm looking into, and I was wondering if you remember what you heard about that. She said, no, sorry, I don't. Long time ago, small town talk, and she was hanging out with bad people, doing bad things. I don't or didn't know the girl you're speaking about. I want to talk to more people who knew Chris and Todd, because clearly there is talk. There always is in small town Vermont. Last episode, Jesenia Pizarro explained that it's really hard to get witnesses for cases involving drugs because they fear retaliation or charges of their own. That's likely exacerbated by rumors that this guy is an FBI informant. What's the point of coming forward if you don't believe anything's going to happen to him anyway? When I interviewed Josh, I asked if he had any names of other people I could try reaching out to.
You know, it's been so long that I've been out of the game, I don't even know some of the people are still in state or even alive, or I don't know, a lot of people, if they haven't got out of drugs by now, they're probably worse than what they were when I was in it, and they probably wouldn't know anything by now anyway. So I don't know, I don't really know anybody that would really have any comment on the subject, to be honest with you.
Jesenia said to me, snitches get stitches is a thing everywhere. But I also can't help but think of an old Vermont proverb, good fences make good neighbors. As a native Vermonter, I've always thought this summed up Vermont's particular attitude, which is, I don't care what you do, so long as it doesn't affect me or change the place I live. In his poem, The Mending Wall, Robert Frost challenges this saying when he asks, why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. If you're listening and you knew Chris Richards or Todd Norris, or remember any talk around town about them or Denise Hart's case in general, for the sake of Denise's family, her mother, friends, siblings, and son, tear down that wall. You can send an anonymous tip to Vermont State Police through their website, but if you don't want to engage with police, you can also feel free to send along information to me via the email buriedinsnowpod@gmail.com or on Instagram and Twitter at buriedinsnowpod or at Jackie O Reports. On the next episode, we'll talk about how Denise's loved ones finally got the answer they hoped they never would. This has been episode 6 of Buried in Snow. The show is hosted, written, and produced by me, Jackie O'Brien, with music by Joseph McDade. If you like the show, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to stay up to date on weekly episodes. If you can, please rate and review. It'll help the podcast grow and Denise's story be spread.